Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special episode of Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 378. It is the Film Wax Radio Doc NYC edition, meaning that all three segments on this particular episode are dedicated to the festival, which purports to be America's largest documentary festival. Why? I don't have any reason to challenge that. It is a very large festival, to be sure. It's going on at the moment. I'm posting a special extra episode. I've got another one that's going to be coming out later this week. I have a lot of interviews that I've done in the last few weeks, which need to be posted pretty quickly. So I might do a couple of extra special episodes in the next few weeks. This is one of them for sure. The festival started this past Thursday, so I've already lost a weekend of telling you about a lot of the premieres. But the good news is, if you're in the New York area and you want to see some great documentaries, this is the festival for you. This is the seventh year, the seventh festival. I think I've been to all of them in some mode or manner. It says that they have more than 250 films and panels presented by over 300 filmmakers and special guests. The majority of the festival screenings take place at the IFC Center, as well as the SVA Theater on West 23rd Street, and then finally Cinépolis, which was the Bowtie Theater, which was something else before that and something other before that. But that's also on West 23rd Street on the east side of 8th Avenue. So everything, that's almost everything will be in those three theaters. But if you just even want to go down, let's say, to the IFC Center, you can keep busy all day. So there's a few more days of the festival. As I read this, I think there's three more days. There's today, and I think it ends by Thursday night. But there's tons of screenings going on and plenty of filmmakers still around to talk to you. So if you're interested, go and check it out. And so let's just get into it. Oh, when it came down to deciding who I was going to talk to from the festival, I went with people that I knew already. That's not typical of how I approach it. I usually go by films that interest me or other factors that are external. But this time I said, you know, I have actually quite a few friends with films at this festival, including Michael Galinsky and Suki Hawley, who I have a great attachment to, and we discuss all of our history in this interview. The movie they made is called All the Rage. It's about Dr. Sarno, who is a famous pain doctor. He has written some books that have helped so many people, including even some celebrities in this case, including Howard Stern and Larry David and others. He's helped, people immeasurably, and they're in the documentary. But mostly it's really more of a personal story. So it's very fascinating. A couple of years ago, Michael and Suki made Battle for Brooklyn. It was a film that I showed in Rough Cut and then ended up like hosting several more screenings of over the next year or two. And now they're back with All the Rage. And so I invited Michael and Suki back to the show. After that, we're going to get back with my friend and neighbor, Sabina Krayenbuhl, who, along with Zeva Oldbaum, have a documentary called Letters from Baghdad, which is in the festival. It's already played, so I apologize for that. But at least you get an idea of the kinds of films that you can see at this festival. In addition, Sabina and Zeva were on a prior episode a couple years ago, also when they were just getting this film going and trying to raise money for digitizing a lot of the archive material that they were using in the film. So we'll come to that. Again, that's called Letters from Baghdad. And finally, my friend Thomas Leach, who has been on also, I think, a year or two back with his last documentary about the photographer Saul Leiter. And now Thomas is back with a new documentary that's also at the festival called The Lure. And if everything works out, maybe you might even get a chance to see it. I think it might be screening today. So I'm going to get this posted pretty quick. Okay, so first we have the documentary All the Rage about Dr. Sarno and dealing specifically with psychological issues around pain. It's a great documentary. So first up here, Michael Galinsky and Suki Hawley, and we'll be back after that.
The subject is pain. But we're not talking about pain that's due to some structural abnormality, but rather the pain that is generated in us when we put ourselves under pressure to be perfect and good.
For the past 10 years, I've struggled to overcome back pain.
How'd I end up on the floor? Life, marriage, kids, fixing up our house, finishing our films, stress.
So when it finally went completely out and I was screaming on the floor in pain, I called Dr. Sarno.
What were you told was the cause of your pain?
I had an L4, L5 disc protrusion that was extreme.
Well, that couldn't possibly explain all the different places where you have the pain. Do you understand that?
I consider that I practice very conservative standard medicine, and my theories may involve the unconscious, but that doesn't make them any less rigorous.
It's a part of life. The things that are going on inside you that cause this to happen are part of life. It's part of everybody's existence.
Michael Glinsky
was more than
No. You, Suki was on once.
Yeah.
With Sue and, was it Kelly?
Kelly.
It was Amy? No, I don't think Amy was that one. It was like, I think it was just like the, might have been the four of you.
She should have been.
Well, you know, the thing is when you're doing a, you know, an audio thing, you don't want like 10 people on it if you cannot avoid
just
it. Cause
four is about the
it's top. That's even too many, but yeah. But that it was fine because we were promoting the Brooklyn Reconstruct series.
The gentrification forum.
I've been trying to not think really truthfully about inevitable about what's gone on this week, and I'm just blocking it for the moment because I can't. But every so it's just a little bit like will creep in like another thing that is a result of that, like just yet another. Oh, there's so many hundreds and hundreds of horrible potential results of this. What's going on? So I'm trying not to deal with it right now. I'm trying
also,
to push it away.
There really is a spirit. Hold
it closer.
Of collective action, in some way, of people saying, "I know maybe we haven't been on the same page about some of the stuff that's going on, and some of us haven't been as active as we really should have been. We've been more observers rather than participants." And I do believe that ugly things are going to take place over the next couple of years. But in that tumult, hopefully, we will have some very positive changes.
That people will feel like they want to differentiate themselves from that. You know, that we are not that, and now that's there.
Uh-huh.
And it's like maybe he gets rid of all the, Yeah, and
well, this is okay. I mean, just because I was walking over, I just remembered. Not that I ever really forgot it, but I had not been thinking about it. I've been really making an act of like just to shut down, which is not typical. But I was thinking. I remember he doesn't believe in global warming, for instance. And then I was also thinking they set it up so perfectly. There's nothing we can do because we have to keep Donald Trump as the president. Because if we don't, then Mike Pence will be the president,
yeah.
And he's even worse, if possible,
right.
On a whole other level. But he's actually, and in a way, we can only assume that he'll be making the big decisions anyway. I don't know, like the Cheney kind of relationship. Mm. But anyway, I can't. I get straight down about it. And you guys have a really upbeat film. It's a lot of laughs. There's musical numbers in it. You actually have the only documentary that I've ever seen that has in its cast. Or among its subjects, you have Howard Stern and Larry David, so it's got to be.
And Bernie Sanders.
And Bernie Sanders, right. And Dr. Sarnow.
Sarnow, who's a comedian himself.
Funny, actually.
Yeah, I bet he is.
He can be.
Very wry, I assume.
Good word.
Uh-huh. And it doesn't seem like he really wants to show that off either. He's not like, right. It's just something that gets inserted from time, because you don't see, you know, he's very unassuming looking, very
right.
Well, small.
I mean, stature. In some ways, stature-wise. We should step backwards a couple of steps because
absolutely.
Nobody knows what we're talking about.
That's very true. Although I will have done an intro, which will explain the film in a nutshell. But we should.
Yeah,
step
but I'm up. Out on a limb. I walked in 15 minutes late to the movie. I don't know what we're talking about.
Oh, I thought you were going to say to this conversation.
In this conversation, because we didn't see the opening. Anyway, so what? Maybe tell us what the opening is, so that I'll know what I have to explain.
What do you? Oh,
Oh, I see what you're saying. I'll start off and you interrupt me. I remember seeing footage that you sent me years ago mm-hmm. when Battle for Brooklyn was out or, you know, in the circuit mm-hmm. and audiences were finding it. There were lots of great events and screenings around Battle for Brooklyn, but I remember you were already well on your way with this other story that you're trying to get off the ground a couple of times.
Right.
And you were going through periodical times of great suffering and pain with your own back.
That might have been a better title. Times of Great Suffering. Although actually,
All the Rage.
All
I was kind of curious
pretty
about
good
that.
Right now, actually.
Sure. Well,
so the movie, in a nutshell, is largely about a doctor named Dr. John Sarno, who wrote a book called Healing Back Pain. Mm-hmm. And he wrote it because he came to the understanding that the great pain epidemic that we were beginning in the mid to early 70s was actually a psychosomatically created illness rather than a structural problem. And he thought that the problem was repressed rage, mm-hmm. oftentimes rage from childhood. Mm-hmm. And of course, all of his peers thought he was wacko. They just completely dismissed him out of hand, yet he had incredible success in treating patients. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting now is in the last couple of days, because we're having this conversation a couple of days after the great unawakening of mm-hmm. America,
right.
In which there have been lots of articles, including in science magazines, et cetera, saying that the reason Donald Trump won was because the power of rage to basically disorient people. And he basically pulls up all this rage. And when you are in a rage, you literally cannot think straight. Mm-hmm. It's almost like having a concussion. And so it is all the rage that won the election for Donald
absolutely,
Trump.
Absolutely. There's no other explanation.
Going back to the idea that Sarno predicted that there would be an epidemic of pain, because he did see this as, pain being caused by repressed emotions back in the 70s, and nobody was listening, and so therefore they were not, they were getting the wrong diagnosis.
And he likened it to during the Black Plague. If people simply knew to wash their hands, mm-hmm. then you would have stopped it immediately. Because if you know what the cause is, you can address it. But if you only treat the symptomology, you're going to get an epidemic, mm-hmm. is what he wrote back in the 70s. And he was correct. Because when we started, so to roll backwards a little bit more.
No, Pete, and do. But I want to just stay in the 70s for a second because...
I want to stay in the 70s forever.
Yeah. Because that's what was the advent of popular talk therapy started, really. There was a way, maybe the tail end of the 60s into the 70s is when people started going to therapists, at least in mm-hmm. progressive, a lot of Jewish households. Like my parents' generation totally bought in. They weren't into the EST thing. They were about talk therapy. And, I wonder if that didn't actually open a can of worms, because if you can just not think about something like I was trying to do most of this week, at first anyway, it kind of works. But you're saying
after a while.
Right.
The rage will come out.
It will.
Because it actually takes a lot of physical and emotional effort
to hold it down,
to keep it in the pit of your stomach.
And
it's largely unconscious. That's
right.
The thing. So these things are all about the unconscious. And so it is interesting, though, because to roll backwards. All right, so one of the things... When he came up with these ideas, and he basically came up with it because he was treating people and all the standard care didn't work. The bed rest and the physical therapy and everything
surgery.
Else that he'd been taught, it didn't really work. So then he started to look at his patients' charts, and he found that 80% of them had a history of two or more other psychosomatic illnesses like eczema or colitis or migraines or just other things that were known to have a mind-body connection. Yeah. So then he started to talk to his patients, and he realized that most of them were very repressive of certain things. They wouldn't even kind of go there. Like, they wouldn't talk about things that seemed uncomfortable. And when he got them to make the connection that it was possibly created by stress, they started to get better. Mm-hmm. When they stopped being afraid that something was going to be wrong with them forever, mm-hmm. they got better. Mm-hmm. So he continued to develop his theories, and he also went to look at the data that supported bed rest and traction and all this stuff, and he found that there actually wasn't any. It wasn't supported by scientific studies. It was just standard care that had been done for
a long
time.
You're not even talking about Big Pharma. I mean, we're not even talking about that. That's a whole other layer to it.
No,
you rolled back before that. I understand.
Before that.
Right. Because it was like a gift to...
To me. Set that up nicely.
Yeah.
Because actually, he had a great deal of success, but he was totally ignored. And so he just became cloistered in his institution. But what he predicted happened. So you started to have increased problems. And it started to spread because it's also a cultural contagion. So you hear about somebody having this, and then that's right. where so his theory was that it was a direct product of the unconscious causing the pain to distract you from uncomfortable emotions. So it provided a way to keep, so in the way any other distraction might, like your cell phone might be a distraction until that can't distract you enough anymore, and then it strikes you down. But what's interesting is my father read the book in the 80s. My father almost died of an ulcer when I was in second grade. So he would definitely, you know, held in his stress. And a couple years, I don't know, because I was in second grade, we were in a fender bender, the whole family. I mean, it was like 3 miles an hour. And he ended up with whiplash, which plagued him for years. Now, my father was a psychologist. Mm-hmm. And when someone gave him Dr. Sarno's book a few years later, immediately understood what he was talking about and immediately basically got better. And didn't have those same kind of back pains for a long time.
After the car, the fender bender.
Yeah,
it was in a way an excuse for his physical,
for his emotional
ego or his physical self to distract his emotional self. It was like here's your excuse. You now have a reason to have back pain and neck pain and to suffer physically, so you don't have to deal with the emotional.
Because the ulcer didn't work anymore. No, really. I mean, it's like it will migrate. And what was interesting also is that once that the whole culture understood that ulcers were stress related, it stopped being as effective, and that's when you start to have the pain.
Wow. So it sounds viral. It's like you treat a virus, but it learns to mutate. You know what I mean? Literally.
Exactly.
Viruses mutate so they can survive. And this sounds like almost like a version of that.
Sarno calls it the symptom imperative, where, you know, once your mind becomes alert to the fact that your tennis elbow is doing it because of some emotional reason, then it doesn't work anymore, and so it goes to your neck and it goes to your shoulder.
It's trying as hard as it can.
Because he started to find that patients would get over one thing and then they would come back with another, or they would go somewhere else.
But if you know that, you know, maybe some sort of some pathology you're going through, like a back pain or a neck pain, is indeed a psychological rooted problem, and you know that and you deal with it, how can it move? Because you're still, it's not like you don't become aware of it. But what's the next step that Sarno taught the people so that, it can't mutate anymore?
Here's how his process worked. So at first what he did was he would examine patients physically to make sure there was no structural problem like a crack in the spine or a tumor or something like that. Mm-hmm. When he knew it was just muscular, it was tightness in the muscles.
Like you?
Like me or so many other people, he was able to get people to recognize it. But also, he gave them tools. So the first thing he did is he'd examine you. Then he would give you tools to do, such as journaling about what's going on in your life. There's so much data that if we write down our thoughts, we get them out of our head.
Really?
There's so much data about that. Journaling is the best thing anyone could do.
Really?
You don't even have to read it again. You just want to write it down.
The act of doing it.
The act of writing. Not typing either. It's really writing.
You have to write it.
You have to write it.
It's called writing therapy. You can Google it.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Why not typing?
It doesn't seem to be as effective.
Maybe it's
because the manual aspect of the mental aspect. I don't know. I read that the other day.
Because it's more personal. It's actually connected to you, and it comes out through your arm and onto the page, and then it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. Anyway, but so that was the first step, is like you read his book, you kind of really do it. Then you go to his lecture where he really lays it out and gives you lots of scientific data. So, for instance, we were talking about my father and whiplash, right? Now, whiplash, there's so much proof that it's a mind-body related issue. In the turn of the century, we had railway spine. When the railroad started, people started getting railway spine, but it was a social contagion, and it eventually disappeared. People thought that the shaking of the train was messing up their spines.
We laugh at it now, but probably thousands of people might have been suffering from something, needlessly.
Right, well, so...
It's interesting.
These guys did this experiment where they looked at the rate of whiplash in Lithuania and in, I think it's Sweden, which is right next door. In Sweden, 30% of the people in a car accident had whiplash. That was debilitating and required, like, all kinds of help. Mm-hmm. In Lithuania, it did not exist. Nobody had whiplash. And if you think about how the mind-body problem works, if you go to a doctor, and a lot of this is sparked by fear, all this is connected to the autonomic nervous system and the fight-or-flight response. If you go to a doctor and they say, be very careful, you know, you really got to watch your neck, you may have whiplash, and if you have whiplash, it's really bad and it will last for years.
That creeps into...
It's power suggestion.
Yeah.
But if they say to you, you know, you may have heard of whiplash, but we really know that that's complete bullshit. And your neck may hurt for a couple of days, but you're going to be fine.
This sounds like the carpal tunnel phenomenon, which was also debunked largely because they said this was also the result of hysteria, like the whole
hysteria. But see, when you use the word hysteria, it makes it seem like everyone's hysterical. But really, what it is most illness has a relationship between the mind and the body, and this goes back to this other aspect of the story. So the story is largely about Dr. Sarno. It's also a very personal story because I said, like, my dad went to see him, then my brother went to see him, and I ended up in his office, and that's how we started this movie.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
That was in 2004.
Okay.
And we started shooting. We weren't able to figure out how to make the story, and it kind of went on hold. And then when it happened again in 2011, we had to make it. Right, so hysterical is really the wrong idea, but it's really just, it's cultural.
Mm-hmm.
So these things that we have are related to what we expect and what we believe. Like, one person we didn't interview, but we read her book. It's called Dance of Shadows, and I can't remember the woman's name.
The Cure Within, actually.
The Cure Within. But she basically looked at the history of mind-body medicine, Ann Harrington.
Okay.
And one aspect of that book was about hypnosis, and what she found as she studied it was that it manifests itself very differently every 10 years. Mm-hmm. So like in the 1870s, and I don't have this right, like people walked around with their arms straight out like a zombie, and then 10 years later it was all like palsy, and then it was speaking in tongues. But it was like what was expected, the unconscious provided.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all these strange connections with how these things work, and all of these things are cultural. And that goes back to what I was saying, is in 2004 we tried to start making this movie. Nobody wanted to hear of it. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with it. People were enraged if we told them that, you know, your back problem might be psychosomatic.
They feel like you're talking down to them, that you're patronizing
them. You're blaming them or patronizing them. You're saying this is my head. This isn't, I feel this. And we also applied for probably 30 or 40 grants and didn't get any. Then also we had been typically making very much Verite follow docs, and we were trying to do that with Dr. Sarno, but he wouldn't introduce us to patients because of, you know, ethical reasons. We couldn't find anyone to bring to him. He published a book at that time, but he didn't do anything. He didn't
press.
There was nothing, no press, and there was no media about him except for a 1999 John Stossel piece. And we were trying, and we felt a lot of respect for him.
He's also in your documentary, by the way.
Yeah, and John Stossel was in the piece. But it was just very hard. We couldn't figure out how to make it, and we shot 6 hours of tape. And for us, you know, we shoot 6 hours of tape a day on some projects over 3.5 years, and eventually it just kind of petered out, and we just were kind of embarrassed for him.
And you had another big project that was getting a lot of attention, on the other hand.
No, we were
was that some years later?
We were working on, this is 2006 that we kind of put it on hold. And that's when we were finishing Code 33, and we were working on Battle for Brooklyn for years. And we were working on that Broken Angel movie, all these different things, but we weren't able to figure out how to do it. So when it happened in 2011 again, that's when I was like, we're making this fucking movie. Literally, when I hit the floor in terrible pain, I screamed that, and we grabbed the camera. And so David started shooting, but it was really revelatory when we started it back up, because this had been 5 or so, 6 years that we hadn't been able to work on it. And in that time, so many other books had come out by doctors, like a gastroenterologist had written, named Dr. David Clark, had written a book called They Can't Find Anything Wrong. 7,000 cases where he slowly had discovered that the mind-body aspect was huge with gut issues. Mm-hmm. And then there was another guy named Gabor Mate who'd written When the Body Says No, or The Body Says No. And he says that if you can't say no, if you're so repressed of your emotions that you don't even realize that you're angry, like if someone says to you, like for instance, say you have a broken ankle and you're walking down the street with your crutches and someone says, hey, can you lift up on the back of my car and help me get out of the ditch? You would put down your crutches and try and figure out how to do it rather than say, that's ridiculous. How can you ask me that? Because you can't say no. Mm-hmm. And these are learned behaviors from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about patterns of behavior that you just are not even aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it leads to all the autoimmune diseases, and there's a lot of data that shows that. And what's interesting is we also found that people were more open to the idea as well. So it was a completely different process. And what's even more interesting, in the 4 or 5 years that we've been working on it since then, I mean, it has exploded in understanding. Like, everybody gets it now. And, like, 2 weeks ago, I started reading a book called
Keeps the Score.
The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk.
These names just roll off the tongue.
But like Gabor Mate, he's a child of Holocaust survivors.
Okay.
And he studied trauma. And he came to understand that, this is going back to that 70s idea. This is when he was starting to work in this thing. That talk therapy can be very useful. But when you have deeply seated trauma, it's actually a very physical process that circumvents the talking cognitive mind. It is a automatic, physical, autonomic reaction, the kind of panic that people mm-hmm. have when they have PTSD. And you can't actually deal with it with talk therapy. You actually have to deal with the trauma itself. And you have to do it through different techniques that actually hypnosis. Activate the autonomic nervous system. I haven't actually gotten to the part of the book that okay. lays out all the cures, okay. but like, you know, like rapid eye movement therapy in which sometimes oh. this releases these things.
Certain light, you know, that like they do for depression.
Right.
So, like there's a seasonal depression. Okay. One way to deal treat that is with the special lamps mm-hmm. that seems to work.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's interesting, like there's other ways than talk. We've been for generations
right.
taught that talk therapy is, you know, can kind of help you, you know, get yourself out of the psychological weeds.
Right. But it's interesting when we're talking about unconscious, mm-hmm. you know, things that are like have their genesis in the unconscious. How could you talk about that if you're not yeah. conscious of it? So you could understand why you'd have to find some other way.
But this goes back to this other idea. So as I was saying, the movie's about Dr. Sarno. It's about myself,
right.
but it's also just about culture and what is science. And we have a short kind of animation in it, which kind of tracks the history of science, which is really like a kind of the Hegelian dialectic where there's, you know, the kind of the divide between the mind and the body.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have the most success is when you're in that balance place between understanding the mind and the body. And so when you have this biotechnical advances like antibiotics, or vaccines, we had this kind of like, it's all science is going to solve this through the body in this almost mechanical way and completely ignored the mind to the point that you can't even talk about it. And so you did have people dealing with mind issues, but completely disconnected from health. So it's like, oh, you're having emotional problems. Let's deal with those, but not even making any connections. So they weren't talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he had started when, you know, understanding about medicine when Freud was still somewhat in vogue. So Dr. Sarno had that understanding, was able to kind of keep that going. And so the movie really becomes about this idea. Like if you look at, there's a doctor named Dr. Semmelweis. And I don't remember the time frame, but was the 16th century or so. He came to see that women who gave birth in a medical facility, which was not a very clean place at the time, they were wildly more likely to get sepsis than ones who were born at home. And he just kind of studied it with a midwife. And he conjectured that it had something to do with the doctor going from one woman to the other.
Yeah, I remember this.
Without washing your hands.
Right.
And so he said, you really need to just wash your hands. I think it will help. And they laughed at him and ridiculed him. And he ended up in an insane asylum. And of course, he had discovered germ theory and he was right. But because they couldn't see it, mm-hmm. they didn't believe it. And this is interesting, too, because, you know, doctors poo-poo the autonomic, like that the gut for many of the last decades that mm-hmm. the gut was involved in understanding things, because they looked at the limbic system and they saw it stopping at the neck. And they said it doesn't even connect to the brain. Of course, last summer, some doctors at Johns Hopkins finally found these microscopic veins that continued on from the limbic system to every aspect of the brain. And so now they're like, oh, I guess there is a connection between the brain and the rest of the body and the autonomic nervous system. But because they couldn't see it, they said it was bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes about this kind of hubris of science, the hubris of polling, the hubris of mm-hmm. of experts believing they know everything. Like, and we know this in terms of being filmmakers, we're filmmakers in this room, we are constantly subjected to this idea that other people are going to judge what you have, and if they don't like it, they don't like the data of it. They don't like the format. No one's going to see it because you can't. You have to get it past these gatekeepers all the time. And
right.
it's the same thing if you're a doctor. If you don't have the science, but as Dr. Sarno says, how do you measure this and quantify it and qualify it? These things are wildly complex. And so when we deny complexity, and that's part of the problem with science. Actually, one of the things that helped us a great deal as we worked on this film was early on when we restarted it, was we found an article by Jonah Lehrer called Trials and Errors, Why Science is Failing Us. And it details all this, and we were really attracted to it because they had this article about the data on herniated discs. Mm-hmm. It turns out that they are not a causative factor if you look at the data. If you do a blind study on 300 people, some have pain, some don't, and you give those scans, those MRI scans to like the reader,
mm-hmm.
they can't tell you who has pain. They'll say, oh my God, that guy, I'm sure that guy can't walk. Totally fine. Because it turns out that they looked at it and they saw it and they go, that's the problem. But it turns out it wasn't, because it doesn't actually correlate. Because people would have beautiful scans. Their backs look wonderful, and they're in debilitating pain.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And people who had crazy looking backs, and they nah, doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the problem with science and the hubris of it. Without, you know, it wants to say we know the answer, but oftentimes it doesn't.
But what's really crazy is they didn't do that study about the MRIs and the herniated discs for many, many years. So they were doing all this surgery on these herniated discs because people coming in with pain, they would find the herniated disc. Mm-hmm. But then
what's even crazier is, like, when we started this movie back in 2004, there was an article. There have been tons of articles about it. So in 2004, there's an article by, I think it was a woman named Gina Collada at the New York Times, mm-hmm. and which said that all this data shows the herniated disc, you know, is not a proper diagnosis. And I wrote to her and said, would you be in the film? And she said, absolutely not. I won't talk to any press. You know, I am the press. It was 6 months ago, she published another article. This is now 12 years later, saying, we ran this article many, many years ago, and nothing has changed. If anything, there's even more surgery. But how is this happening? It was actually kind of a very frustrated article saying,
because you make some progress, and then we did say, then the pharmaceutical companies have a lot invested, I suppose, in your suffering. So,
right.
You know, yeah, they're investing in an all new generation, right? No. Yeah.
Man, I really talked a lot.
Well, yes, we're supposed to do on a. You're supposed to do on the podcast. It's the perfect guest wrapped in a conundrum, right? All the Rage is having its North American, New York, world. I'm just taking
world
stands.
Premiere.
World premiere at Doc NYC 2016, alongside Thomas Leach's The Lure. And
Saturday at 7:30, and again on Tuesday at 9:45.
Dr. Sarno and his wife will be there,
as well as many
other doctors that are in the movie. John Stossel will be there.
How'd you get that? I asked you.
Yeah, no, he wasn't. We're hoping he's going to show up. He's not in the best health, but hopefully he'll
show up. He's 93 years old. So I think that the diagnosis for anything wrong when you're that age is you're 93. I said this.
And you were forced to retire, which makes you upset.
Well.
Press some rage about that, maybe. Maybe.
Right. Does he have the capacity to suppress rage? I suppose anybody does.
He does. And, you know, he says in the film that he's had more psychosomatic problems than most of his patients. And, you know, but he just understands.
Yeah.
What to do in that, but they keep coming, you know. Mm-hmm. Even though he understands, even though he's the founder of this theory, these pains keep coming, these symptoms keep coming, and you just have to keep understanding that the world is complex and your mind is doing stuff.
I barely scratched the surface. There's so much more one can talk about because it's so many issues around this are so interconnected,
right?
You know, from the personal to the political to the.
It is a very personal film, and that was a really hard balance to find. That's why it took us 7 years to edit.
Wow. Well, it gets very personal, you know, at a certain point in the film.
Yeah. You know what we realized the other day?
Family loss.
Mm. On a personal level, the film has four weddings and a funeral. It does.
Again, crunching numbers here. Saturday night, world premiere of All the Rage at, where is it?
IFC
Center. And sounds like a great screening. What time is it?
7:30.
Mm-hmm.
It is wildly sold out. So they did ask. I mean, they did add one on Tuesday night at 9:45.
Oh, great. That's fantastic. Yeah. Congratulations.
Well, it's not so fantastic because a lot of people are upset they couldn't get in.
Yeah, well, it just comes down to watching a good documentary at the end of the day. And you guys will be there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michael and Suki are in town. Michael was on episode number 2. Of this podcast.
That's how old I am. And what we talked about last night is Adam and Suki and I, we shared a nanny.
And Karen.
And Karen. Yeah, a nanny
when
back.
You children or when you have...
That's right.
We each paid a nanny to watch our children together.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Jacob was with you.
Come over with Jacob and pick up Harper.
Wow.
And Jacob was like, I think, 6 months older than Harper.
Yeah, that's where they're very close in age.
Yeah. Maybe even a year. And so he would be in the
stroller. He's in seventh grade anyway. Yeah. Okay. Oh,
yeah,
wow.
She's in fifth. Jeez. So he was actually 2, I guess. And she was, so it was easy for her. She could take the baby and Jacob.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she was, we were saying, a great nanny, great lady.
All hail.
I miss her. And then our kids ended up being in the same school, mm-hmm. PS11. And then all this craziness with this, some arena was going on. You know anything about it?
Oh, the arena.
Have you seen Battle for Brooklyn?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you should take a look at that, Thomas. Yeah.
Trade links.
Yeah, yeah, you should definitely do that. And I think you really love this, not only the lure, but the Saul Leiter doc is great. So, and then I watched, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is pretty darn great, actually.
Thank you. You shouldn't judge so quickly my emails.
I know. That's true. Well, I learned.
It's interesting. As we said, we also knew each other because our kids went to this really great school in our neighborhood called PS 11. And one day in the hallway, it was actually 3 days after we were back at school from Hurricane Sandy, and mm-hmm. Suki and I were taking Battle for Brooklyn that morning to go to San Francisco, and I just got an iPhone, and this guy stops me in the hall. He goes, oh, are you on Instagram? I was like, oh, no, I just got
really?
This. And I've always been a photographer, but I hadn't really been taking pictures for a while. And he's like, oh, here, let me show you mine. And I was like, those are all the pictures from the New Yorker of Hurricane Sandy. Those are what the hell? And he's like, yeah. So he was like the very first early adapter to Instagram as a photographer, and his name is Ruddy Roy. And now he has 270,000 followers on Instagram. But that's how
if
we met.
If he can harness that and use it for good.
But he's very, very influenced by Saul.
Oh, okay.
And, so he's a big proponent, and you should actually look at his work. But he's an amazing photographer, an amazing human. And it's this interesting thing that seems so relevant at this moment, how profoundly important it was to go to the local school in the neighborhood mm-hmm. where you meet the people that you live around and become gain a much greater understanding of the world outside your island. And I think we, as parents, learned exponentially more than Fiona ever did from our experience at that school.
For sure. It forced us into, it's an interesting thing. I was going to say uncomfortable
forced,
conversations,
yeah.
But I don't know if it is forced because you're grateful for it. Hopefully if you're
it
a thoughtful
made the way
person.
For a lot of and, really interesting
Yeah.
Learning.
Well, and also, but having also Reese right before that being in a in an interesting building, living in a building. Karen and I had come from Manhattan, mm-hmm. where I had sold my place around the corner. I lived right around the corner from here for 7 years, and then when I got married, I sold that place, and we moved to an apartment building up on 108th Street on Fifth Avenue. But it was a project at one point, and it had been going through that slow conversion,
right.
where younger buying at market value, younger, right. mostly white people had been moving in for the last bunch of years, but they're still the original tenants who were living in East Harlem, you know,
yeah.
who were there. And there was a kind of a, I don't want to say a divide, but there was. But also it was tense because, you know, there was this threat to the people that could only afford a small amount of money. Mm-hmm. But now these apartments were going for market value. That things were becoming less affordable. Yeah. So it was an interesting thing where you had to kind of talk to your neighbors and recognize that this was a reality
right.
that was a greater force than your own.
And this was this was all going on as we were shooting and making Battle for Brooklyn, which
right.
informed that whole process.
Yeah. So it spoke to me. Mm-hmm. I know that was an appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Not only sharing a nanny, but thank you guys.
Thank you.
Knowledge is the only prescription that I give to patients. I tell them what's going on, and wow, lo and behold, it stops hurting.
And send me this thing when you're done with it. I'll just see it.
You got it.
For you, the listeners of FilmWax Radio, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, I take a lot of car rides myself, long car rides on the weekends or to work, and I have become very, very addicted to Audible myself. Two titles, for instance, that I recently downloaded was Roger Corman, a prior guest of the show. It's called Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers by Beverly Gray, and also a former guest, William Friedkin. He has his memoir called The Friedkin Connection, two great titles. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio for your free audiobook. Thank you. By the way, Michael's on not only episode number 2, but he was also on episode 46 with Suki. Also in that same episode, the 46th episode, was Sue Friedrich, who was on this very last episode of last week. And also on that episode was the filmmaker Kelly Anderson. And that was episode 46. But Michael and Suki were both on episode 46. And Michael was my second guest ever. So I'm going to try to get those shows posted for you, or should say reposted, and put them back online. So just FYI, I wanted to, in case you're interested in hearing more from those folks, Ziva and Sabina were on episode 203. So that does go back quite a while. That does. With Letters from Baghdad. If you're interested in hearing the first episode or first conversation I had with them, you go to episode number 203 of the podcast. So let's go into now my new conversation with Sabina and Ziva and their film, Letters from Baghdad.
I prefer the east to the west. Its sights and its sounds. In the desert, every newcomer is an enemy till you know him to be a friend.
We believe she is a British spy. Her travels should be prevented.
She knows more about the Arabs and Arabia than almost any other living Englishman or woman.
We rushed into this business with our usual disregard for a comprehensive political scheme. The truth is that I'm in a minority of one in the Mesopotamian political service, yet I'm so sure I'm right that I would go to the stake for it. Oil is the trouble, of course. Detestable stuff.
So we're going to talk about your film, Letters from Baghdad. We were together about a year ago, was it? What do you think?
I think it was about 2 years ago.
It was closer to two?
March 2014.
Because you were doing your Kickstarter then, yes, to raise money for production costs?
We launched the Kickstarter in Women's History Month,
right,
which was in March of that year. And it was in order to help us digitize undigitized.
That's right.
Archival footage.
Yeah, that's right. Which is part of the charm of it, is that you just had so much imagery, photos, and
that was
clips.
One of the challenges when we first began the film is if we were going to find enough footage of the Middle East from 100 years ago.
Of course.
We were very excited and thrilled to find beautiful, stunning clips, some of them hand-tinted.
Is that right?
Yes, and I mean, we looked in archives all over the world, Russia, Netherlands, Germany, and one of the things that we did, which was, which makes the film really beautiful in movie theaters, is that we went back and had them, go to the negatives, and so now the quality of the film is really stunning and immediate, and you really are being transported into that world that Gertrude Bell lived in, and you experience it firsthand through her point of view.
Actual voiceover by Gertrude Bell, reading from texts from original.
Yes, it's Tilda Swinton. She plays Gertrude Bell and reads her letters. So it's the film is based on primary source material.
Right.
And
well, what's nice also is that you get to restore her into the history books in a sense, which is where she was just so unintentionally subtracted,
Yes, it was interesting in our, when we did our research, we really saw firsthand by comparing documents that were written by different people about same events, we saw how different the transmission of information was when the way she described, and we know from photographs and, and political minutes, for example, the Cairo conference that she participated in, we saw that she described it in every detail, and the minutes said there were six people in every meeting, including Winston Churchill and T. E. Lawrence. But then when we looked at the memoirs of the other people that participated, we saw that they did not mention Gertrude Bell. Mm-hmm. So it was very clear that, her male contemporaries weren't happy to include her in the history, in the making of history.
Yeah, well, it just wasn't proper.
That was one of the first things that really struck us when we started to do research, was when we became aware of how very powerful and influential and important Gertrude Bell was, and how little known she is.
Mm-hmm.
She's still known in Iraq.
Right.
But she's almost completely forgotten.
Yeah. And I think we talked about it last time, is that she was one of the very few people responsible for really drawing the borders, right, of Iraq, correct?
Yes. She was mostly responsible for the southern borders,
okay,
which made sense because she spoke Arabic and all the tribal dialects and had relationships with those tribes that were in that region.
How did she? Was she just incredibly well educated? Was she self-educated? Was she living there for a long time and embedded?
Gertrude Bell was incredibly bright.
She
was the first woman to get a first class in modern history at Oxford, and she knew at least 7 or 8 different languages. And when she had gone out into the Arabian desert at the turn of the century, motivated by a sense of adventure and archaeology, she was very meticulous in everything she did. So she drew drawings and took notes on the archaeology, developed relationships with the tribes, and it was really as a result of that that British military intelligence recruited her.
And yes, so, and she eventually ended up in Baghdad in 1917. Before that, she was in Basra and stayed there and died in Baghdad, and is buried there as well. So her grave exists still. It has been tended to by Iraqis. Mm-hmm. And
Is she considered a legend, a hero, or
a hero? Not necessarily. I mean, I think her big legacy is, for one, the museum, the Iraq Museum, and a lot of the Iraqis that we have spoken with, she's remembered. She's remembered there, where she's not remembered, and nobody knows her in the West. And they often speak of her as Miss Bell, in a fond way. She's fondly remembered by a large amount.
Not in the imperialist sort of way that so many others are, because she was there, she lived there, and she...
No, it's actually, we have the accounts from many different people, historians and also journalists, that say specifically Gertrude Bell is the only person remembered with any fondness from that period. But that era, the monarchist era, is remembered by many people in a fond way.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of developing relationships, what is it like to develop? I mean, I know, Ziva, your last documentary was about an author, am I right? Ruth?
Sabina and I both worked on Ahead of Time, which was about Ruth Gruber.
Gruber. Mm-hmm. And that she was a writer?
She was first journalist in the Soviet Arctic in 1935. She did many, many different things. She also was the youngest PhD in the world in 1931.
Yeah.
And then she worked for the Roosevelt administration, and she did. But she was a journalist as well.
Did she know Gertrude or ever meet her? No. Did their paths ever cross? Only through your work.
Well, this is the funny thing. I had read Gertrude Bell's a biography of Gertrude Bell and traveled in the Middle East. And when we worked together on this film Ahead of Time, I thought, because Ruth herself also spent time in Baghdad and was aware of the Middle East, I said, she must know Gertrude Bell. So I asked Ruth, and Ruth said, no, I don't know her.
So you didn't meet her.
She never heard of her, but Ziva was there
she
said, I have just read the biography, and so that's how actually we went on the journey to do the film about Gertrude Bell.
Oh, okay, so there is a strong number of connections, regardless of the fact they didn't meet. But my question, I guess, is, since you guys did know Ruth Gruber, I think I know most of your films that you've edited, Sabine, My Architect, Manhot Ballroom, The Bridge, just to name a few. Those are about, The Bridge is not necessarily about people you ever met, but what is it like to develop a relationship with someone you've never met and because you really, you must have a sense of a real relationship with this person, Gertrude Bell, right?
That's a really interesting question, because we really feel as though we have developed a relationship with her. And as we have the experience of holding her letters in our hands is so different than reading, that is so different than reading a book about someone. It's so immediate. And the one incredibly nice thing that has happened as a result of the film is that we have shown it to Gertrude Bell's descendants, her niece and her niece's children, her half-sister's children, her half-brother's children, and they really feel like we've captured her essence, and that's an incredible compliment to us.
Yes, and, you know, we really dug through 1,600 letters. I mean, she left behind 1,600 letters to mostly her family. And to read those letters, you get a good, you know, behind-the-scenes look, and you really get a sense of the person in the different ways that they relate back to either parents or confidants or political officers. So the character shines through in these letters in ways that, you know, reading a memoir wouldn't be the same.
It's a good thing you didn't call the documentary 1,600 Letters from Baghdad. That might have scared some people off. But is this the world premiere at DocuMYC? No, you had it. Where was the world premiere?
Well, this is our North American premiere, okay. But we were also at the BFI London.
Oh, very good.
And we are going to be at ITFA on November 20th.
Very good. You have how many screenings at DocuMYC?
One.
Oh, just one?
Yeah, November. Okay. It's on Saturday.
This Saturday?
This coming Saturday.
Okay.
Yes. And also, we want to mention that we showed it at the Beirut International Film Festival. Mm-hmm. That was our first Middle East screening.
That was your Middle East premiere?
Middle East premiere, and we won the audience award.
Oh, nice. Okay, so I was going to ask you what the reaction was like, and it was an award. That was the reaction.
Yes, and the audience award, not the jury.
No, right. Yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah, that's terrific.
Yeah, it was great. We had great Q&A, and and then we also showed it in Haifa, and we had sold-out screening.
Wow.
So we can't wait to show it in more places.
No doubt. Finally, how long was it? It must have been a couple of years then, at least 2 or 3 years, 3 years to get this film.
It was 4 years.
4 years?
Yeah, we've been working on it 4 years full-time.
Right.
Since we came up with the plan to work together on it, it took us about 3 years to get our schedules together, and then 4 years of full-time.
Oh, really? Okay, so it was a commitment of 4 years, so you really had to find money for...
We did. We were very fortunate to get 2 NEH grants, a development grant and a production grant, and a New York State Council on the Arts grant. And we were incredibly, incredibly fortunate to connect with wonderful people who were willing to support us through this project.
That's terrific.
As individual contributors.
Well, if you are in New York City... I don't know. Is it sold out?
Sold out
Saturday?
Yeah.
Sold out. So, no rush. Okay. I'll help, too. It's still good to let people know because, you know, if you're by another festival and it happens to be screening at that festival and you know from listening to this that, first of all, if it intrigues you, as it probably has, and you know that it's been selling out, that it's a hot ticket. So go see this. And, you know, are you beginning, not that I need any specifics because it wouldn't be right at this point, but are you guys already figuring out the next steps for the film then?
Sure. We are working on broadcast deals, negotiating broadcast deals. We have a pre-buy. We have sold the film to Arte France in Germany.
Okay.
And negotiating the broadcast deals. And
I imagine forward. Educational and institutional types of would be natural for this film.
Exactly.
Right?
That's part of our plan.
And that's how you pay the bills, too, right?
We'd like to do that.
Yeah. Again, the name of the film is Letters from Baghdad, and it's co-directed by Sabina Krayenbuhl and Ziva Olbaum. And it will be having its North American premiere this coming weekend at DocuMYC. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And we'll meet up again when your broadcast is ready to go and do a real
theatrical release.
There's a lot of options. There's going to be a lot of options for theatricals coming up, at least in New York anyway. I mean, there are more theaters popping up every week here. Everybody, this last segment is with my friend Thomas Leach and his very, very exciting documentary called The Lure. I really highly recommend it. Thomas was back on episode 313, and he's back, so he is the most recent of the guests. But he was on with his last film, In No Great Hurry, 13 Lessons in Life with Saul Leiter, and now he's back with The Lure. And if you get a chance, go check out the screening at DocNYC. Thank you very much. Here's my conversation with Thomas. On the show on Thomas on episode 313.
Oh, okay.
And you were joined by two very other Jewish people. Are you Jewish?
No.
Thomas, are you sure? There's no Jewish lineage? You may want
to. Not really. I don't think so.
No? Okay, because the head of the Woodstock Film Festival, who's Israeli, expat, and then Alan Zweig, who's this very interesting curmudgeon. Do you know who? Do you know Alan Zweig? Yes. Yes, he's in Toronto. Very good. Yeah, they love him up in Toronto. He's a local kind of, you know, hero in the sense of he's a documentary filmmaker. He makes very personal films, and he's a real sort of a curmudgeon. But he had a kid late in life, and it's kind of, you know, it necessarily changes you. But anyway, he's made a number of really great films, really good films, and nobody knows about it. And I was up in Toronto. Well, you know about him, and it's Michael Kalinske. But two years ago, I was up there, and I met with him, and he did the podcast. Anyway, Thomas Leach is back. This is going to probably be like 313. This is probably in the around 377 or something. So it's not that long.
So every 64 podcasts, I'll just keep
is it that many? You to crunch the numbers really fast.
Basic maths is, you know,
yeah,
a fundamental to all my filmmaking.
They're edumacated in the UK.
Yeah, we'll get rid of it soon.
I'm sure. We've already committed to. We've committed. Yeah, that's right. That's right. With two major nightmare elections. Anyway, so we're here on the more positive note. We're here to talk about Thomas Leach's new documentary, which is called The Lure, and your follow-up to Saul Leiter documentary,
mm-hmm,
which was your last one. Do you know about that? You'd like that one.
No, I want to see that.
Oh, it's really good.
Oh, I'll send you a copy.
Yeah, Thomas embedded himself in New York City with Saul.
That's
over
right,
how
yeah.
long? How long period?
I mean, we filmed and became friends and spent time together and made the film over a few years. So, but it was probably a four-year process of hanging out with him. I mean, most of it was spent persuading him to let me make the film, so there's a good deal of that,
yeah,
wrapped in the whole thing.
Yeah. And then he got to watch it's been a while since I've seen it now, but
yeah, he did get to see it before he passed away, so that was always nice.
Yeah. And I think when you were on that episode, you were telling me already about The Lure. I think
I should
have listened to the show again now that I think about it, rather than just guessing. But anyway,
I'm sure. I don't know how much time 64 podcasts is,
you could probably average a week with each one.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure. I started filming this in 2014, so.
Okay. So you're clearly.
We would have been midway through it.
Okay. And to reduce it to its basic synopsis, it's a wealthy.
Forrest Fenn.
Forrest Fenn, of course. So he's stashed away in the mountains, somewhere in the Rockies, which is a very vague, because considering how large range
pretty big. Yep.
Goes through how many states in the United States here?
It goes through six states, but
okay.
A couple of them got ruled out of the treasure.
Well, that's so you're jumping ahead a little bit, but
sorry,
that's right.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm just trying to get a size of the Rockies first.
Huge.
And there's Canadian Rockies, I hear. Anyway, so and so he broadcasts this that he has stashed away a cache of jewels that are probably worth at least a few thousand dollars, if not more. How much? Like just
people
in the millions.
Keep wildly guessing, but somewhere between 1 and 3 million.
Okay.
Is the general consensus.
Okay.
There's thousands of people out there looking for it.
Wow.
So he did it between 5 or 6 years ago. He hit the chest, wrote a poem, and if you can decipher the poem, that will give you the cryptic clues.
Oh, right. They're clues.
It will lead you to the golden jewels, yeah.
And, wow. And so did you start the story right when you heard about this? Obviously, or did you get wind that something like this was going to happen? I mean, how do you, you know, start the documentary early enough in this case?
Well, I'd read a small newspaper article about it from an English paper and thought that sounded great, a treasure hunt, that sounds fun. I'll go and find out whether the guy's for real and also who's out there doing it, because I didn't want it to be a kind of a corporate getaway kind of film or a hagiography about this man doing something. It was much more interesting to me to find out whether people were interested and attached to it in the way that I thought they might be.
Mm-hmm. And you guys, so you also have a handful of the people that are searching, that are on the hunt.
Sure, yeah.
And because, like you say, there are thousands.
Yeah, there's 10. New Mexico, say, the Tourist Board of New Mexico say that there was 50,000 last year out looking for it.
50,000.
Yeah, and I don't know how they count those people, but exactly. Yeah, just random guesses. And. So
the voices you hear in the background are Michael Galinsky and Suki Hawley, who are in another segment momentarily, but they're joining us here.
Heckling.
From the
first hecklers. It's good.
From the bleachers.
Mm-hmm. So to me,
they were probably drooling and it was clear who was there to enjoy nature. Right.
Sure.
And the wilderness and those who were there for the payday.
Yeah, and there's a whole plethora of reasons that they're all searching between those things. So I think everyone out there is off on their own hunt to find something that might not be as obvious as gold.
Mm-hmm. So what did you discover about this? Was it a surprise for you? Because, you know, it seems kind of straightforward. You're going to find people who just are looking for money. But what was unique about the way into the story that really spoke to you?
Well, I think the what you've described so far is really just the hook and the start of the film. It's the context of what it happens in, and all the best films are just about people and trying to find a way in the world and understand the world, and this became a way to make a film like that. These are people who the treasure hunt is both the draw for me and people watching the film, but also for them, so it all took them out there. But then it's about so much more. It's about what you're searching for in life, what completes you, what is the hole in your heart that keeps you doing things. You know, there's obvious parallels to filmmakers, but there's obvious parallels to anything that people feel the need to go out and do, if it's yoga or literature or music or money. Whatever it is, everyone is always looking for that next thing to complete them. Mm-hmm. So to me, all the stories were ones where I felt that they could be interesting and charming and insightful enough to sustain a narrative, because the treasure chase or the treasure hunt was really only the kind of doorway in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's levels of mystery and weirdness, because the guy who hides it emails back and forth with the hunters, and it's definitely... he's definitely a figure that stays involved, and that's the kind of next level of the film. But primarily for me, all docs are about people trying to make sense of the world.
I want to brag about finding the last treasure that, for all we know, will ever be hidden. I want to be the guy that finds the treasure, just so I can brag about it. I would finally show everybody that I am more clever than they are, more witty, more resourceful, more sexy. I just want to brag about it. The actual owning of the treasure, oddly enough, isn't all that attractive. It's the finding it. Part of me says, take a token or two, takes pictures of me with the treasure, take a token and leave it. And then there's the other side that says, David, that is barking mad crazy. Nobody finds a treasure chest and leaves it. I mean, that doesn't happen. I mean, nobody's that crazy.
What was the guy who he had the beard, the kind of awkward
David,
if I can call him awkward. I mean, he just seems like to be uncomfortable with him a little bit, insecure or something. And he's, you know, but he's the one that actually you shoot him, you know, trying to he's trying to I don't know, manipulate the situation, but he's talking to I'm so heavily medicated, so forgive me.
Forrest.
Forrest Fenn. He's talking to Forrest, trying to get some clues out of him. So I'm trying to get, like, you know, to gauge if he's interpreting the clues correctly, etc. So, did you show him with any of the other treasure hunt?
No, they overlap a little, but it was important to show Forrest with one of the treasure hunters. So David was the one that came whilst we were there, and he spent time together, and it's definitely a weird dance that they all take, because Forrest has kept himself at the center of the story and has this amazing following of people who all decipher literally every single word he ever releases in public.
Don't pose. Don't smirk, I should say.
Don't smirk?
No, I've been chastised.
I didn't realize I was.
I didn't either, but apparently...
Okay, good.
He's trying to provoke me. It won't work.
It did.
I said it won't work. Well, you got it. Is this the world premiere?
It is world premiere this Sunday, and then we show again on Tuesday.
Monday night and Tuesday.
Sunday night.
Sunday night? Sunday, night. Oh,
Sunday
evening.
Sunday evening, the 13th, and Tuesday the 15th.
Okay.
In the afternoon.
All right.
And then we'll see what happens.
In terms of future festivals, you mean, and
secondly,
I've seen what's happened, and it's bleak.
Yeah, festivals and sales, and we have our sales agent on board, and hopefully it'll have a wider release, and we'll see.
And has Forrest seen the, that's an unusual name for a man who's buried treasure in an actual forest.
It's but, very apt.
Yeah, it is. What has he seen the film?
Not yet, no.
Oh.
Barely anybody's seen the film. We had a fairly small team, and unless you're involved in some way with the film, you won't have seen it yet.
Any of the people that were searching?
They're coming out for a few of them are coming out for the screening.
Oh, they are,
which will be
great. That's important, and
exciting.
It's that value add.
Yeah, I mean, they all took me on these amazing trips up into the mountains. And
how many times
opened themselves out?
How much time did you spend in the Rockies?
We shot for 7 or 8 weeks spread over a couple of years.
So, and we won't give away. Did somebody find the treasure? We won't say. That would be...
Is it even real? Does it even matter?
Jesus, that's right. Does it matter? It matters to me.
We have a question from the audience.
From the audience, Suki Hawley has a question.
Do we ever find out how Forrest makes sense of the world through the film?
You'll have to see. I think that's an important second layer of the film, because he's kind of like the Wizard of Oz in the story. You know, we keep him hidden, and we keep him as much as anything as a voice and the spirit guide of all these people.
He's a hard fella to read.
Yeah, he's deliberately oblique, and he provokes quite wide reactions. People think he's both evil and a god at the same time.
Like he's toying with people. Because he's either lying about having buried the treasure, or he's just has, and he knows that people can't resist the temptation, but it's like finding a needle in a haystack. I mean, okay, so it's not six states, it's four states. That's bigger than, you know, entire continents, you know, those four states.
Yeah, they're huge and empty. So his view on the world is...
Did you know, Suki, there was a state called, for instance, Wyoming? I hadn't... wasn't even playing. Was that one of the ones that was included?
Yeah, Wyoming's in there.
Oh, good.
Which includes, you know, like Yellowstone, which is not exactly small. So very beautiful and very harsh and kind of full of story, oh, which is the other attractive.
Unforgiving. I like when people... What's that?
It's pretty much the only place in the world that someone could say, I've hidden a treasure, and people would go, okay, great.
Yeah.
Let's go and find it. You know, it's yes. The American Southwest is about the only place where that makes sense.
He does say, though, at a certain point, right, that he knows, Forrest says, and he knows that at least one or more of the parties was within a really close distance. I don't know how that came to be, but...
Nobody knows how he...
Or is he still fucking
with us? He
does
say that.
Yeah. Like, and how many feet? Or like
he says 200 feet.
200 feet of the booty. Seems...
But, I mean, there are all kinds of online forums where the legions of treasure hunters try and determine and decipher everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really want to make a film that has too many facts and too many answers in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite open. I think you can watch the film and have... The idea was always if there was a couple of you going to watch the film, that one of you would think that the whole thing was bullshit,
mm-hmm.
and that nothing was real, the film was terrible and all of that, and the other half were like, that's amazing, I'm going to head out into the hills and find gold.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see.
Well, again, it's called The Lure, and it's directed by Thomas Leach, and it'll be at Doc NYC here in New York on Sunday evening and Monday.
Is that Tuesday?
I'm sorry.
I think we're going to have to do a Monday screening now, just to fill in the gaps.
That's true. Well, it does happen. They have these. They do offer bonus screenings at this festival, so it could very well happen. But it'll be on Saturday night. No, I'm just joking. It'll be Sunday night and Tuesday during the day, right? Do we know the times?
7:45 on Sunday and 3 p.m. on Tuesday.
So if you're in New York, I think there's limited number of tickets for Sunday, from what I hear.
Yeah.
But you probably have a good chance of getting in on Tuesday.
I would think so.
Me too.
3 p.m.? Yeah.
Yeah.
And if not, just creep
now, in a year or two from now, it may be very easy, maybe much harder to get into a movie theater during a work day because it'll probably be a lot, you know, a lot of people out of work. Exactly. Thomas, come back on the show anytime.
Thank you very much.
You know, it's good to see you.
64 from now. I'll try and...
No, you don't have to wait 64.
Okay.
We are here at the Moxie Pictures / Killer Films offices. And it's a nice transition. So, yeah, definitely see this film. What's the full title?
The Lure.
No. Of the Saul Lightner.
In No Great Hurry.
It's the
Saul Lightner film, yeah. 13 Lessons in Life with Saul Lightner.
Yeah. Oh, I said Lightner. See? I'm just having the hardest time. Lighter. Saul Lightner. I beg your pardon. Very short, just say please do subscribe and leave us a comment and star rating on iTunes if you haven't done so. But thanks for listening. Keep spreading the word about the podcast. Filmwax Radio is a part of the Showbiz Studios podcast network, as well as being presented by Rooftop Films, is hosted by myself, Adam Shartoff. And this was episode number 378. Be back literally in just a few days with a new episode regarding the new documentary, which will be on HBO, called Marathon, The Patriots Day Bombing. I think that's pretty self-explanatory, but we're going to have the filmmakers Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg back on the podcast. They're returning to the podcast again with their new documentary, which will be on HBO, as well as a couple of subjects from the I will call them survivors from the atrocity that took place at the Boston Marathon a couple of years back, where there were a couple of bombings at the finish line. And we have a couple of the survivors from that incident also on the next episode. In the next episode, we also have Alex Lehman, who is a filmmaker. He has two films, both currently screening in theaters. One is a narrative film called Blue Jay, starring Sarah Paulson and Mark Duplass. And he has also a documentary, which we're going to talk about, called Asperger's Are Us. So that's coming up on the next episode. And finally, Michael Schrago, who is a programmer for Filmstruck, which is the new streaming service that is... It's a partnership between the Criterion Collection and Turner Classic Movies, and we're going to have Michael on to discuss that new enterprise, which everybody that listens to this podcast, I'm sure, is quite excited about. So that's what's going on. This is your host, Adam Chartoff, FilmWax Radio. Until the next time, please do take care of yourself and the ones you love.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads, people sleeping in broken beds. Ain't no use jiving, ain't no use joking, everything is broken. Broken bottles, broken plates, broken switches, broken gates.